From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as part of our weekly archive edition of the show, we feature an interview that many listeners requested to hear again. Dr. Peter Kramer is the author of the bestseller Listening to Prozac, about antidepressants and the medicalization of personality. Dr. Kramer says new antidepressants are raising fascinating but complicated questions about the human condition, such as how much of your personality is biologically based, and how willing should we be to chemically alter personality. Also today, can the Beverly Hillbillies survive the big screen or the 1990s? Stephen Schiff has a review of the new movie based on the old TV show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has ordered six American warships to enforce the United Nations embargo against Haiti. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
The administration has been wrestling with a way to increase pressure on Haiti's military leaders. The recent assassination of Haiti's justice minister dashed hopes that the heads of the army and national police would step aside, as they had agreed. President Clinton said the U.S. stands strongly behind the return of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
The military authorities in Haiti simply must understand that they cannot indefinitely defy the desires of their own people, as well as the will of the world community.
The U.S. warships will stop and search vessels on their way to Haiti to see if they are carrying oil or arms. The president stopped short of calling the action a blockade, which would be an act of war. Under a U.N.-brokered agreement, Aristide is supposed to return to his country at the end of this month, but the defiance of Haiti's military leaders makes it unclear if that plan is still viable. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
The U.N. Security Council has postponed a vote on the resolution calling for the embargo on Haiti. Diplomats said there's no doubt the resolution will be adopted, but the vote was delayed while the Chinese delegation waits for instructions from Beijing. Once it's passed, the resolution would take effect at midnight on Monday. In Port-au-Prince, the director of the UN team that's monitoring human rights abuses in Haiti says his workers are being evacuated to the Dominican Republic. Earlier today, the teams were called back from towns in the countryside where they'd been working. A South African judge has ordered death sentences for two white conservatives for the assassination of black leader Chris Hani last April. The sentence was cheered by supporters of the African National Congress, who maintained a courtroom vigil throughout the trial. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The death penalty was imposed on Polish immigrant Janusz Wallace, the man convicted of gunning down Hani, and on Clive Darby Lewis, the conservative party official who supplied the gun. Yesterday, Darby Lewis's wife, Gay, was acquitted of charges in the assassination. Although ANC supporters criticized her acquittal, they expressed satisfaction with today's death sentences for Wallace and Darby Lewis. Those sentences will not be carried out anytime soon. The government has suspended executions until after elections for a new government of national unity, scheduled for next April. Hani was a top leader in the ANC, which opposes the death penalty, though ANC President Nelson Mandela today said the issue would have to be reviewed after next year's elections. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 8 points to close at 3,629.7. This is National Public Radio News. The jury in the Reginald Denny beating trial didn't resume its deliberations today. Court officials said that one juror is ill, so the start of deliberations has been put off until tomorrow. The jury must start its work from scratch after two jurors were dismissed this week, one for failure to deliberate and another for unrelated personal problems. Yesterday, the judge in the case refused a defense motion to dismiss a third jury, based on the claim that she was having what amounted to a nervous breakdown. Miami area police continued to hunt for a rooftop sniper who killed one man and wounded two others last night near Miami International Airport. Published reports suggest the shooting is linked to the upcoming trial of two men charged with trafficking some $2 billion in cocaine. Doug Phillips reports from Miami.
One of the men left critically wounded after the shooting is named Ray Cruz. He's the brother of Lazaro Cruz, who's now in the Federal Witness Protection Program. Lazaro Cruz is scheduled to testify against Willie Falcone and Sal Magluta, who authorities say ran one of Miami's most sophisticated and violent cocaine trafficking organizations. Sources told the Miami Herald that unable to reach federally protected Lazaro Cruz, associates of Falcone and Magluta may have tried to exact revenge by shooting his brother. The man who was killed in last night's sniper attack is described as an innocent victim. In addition to the upcoming drug trial, Falcone and Magluta are being investigated for possible links to the murders of two other men who were scheduled to testify against them. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
The House voted overwhelmingly today to extend unemployment benefits for about 1 million out-of-work Americans who are expected to use up their regular benefits by February. The bill provides for up to 13 weeks of additional payments. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you think your nose is too long, you can fix it. If you don't like your wrinkles, you can get a facelift. Will we soon be able to change our personalities with similar ease by taking a pill to get rid of depression, insecurity, or fear of rejection? My guest, Dr. Peter Kramer, thinks we are entering an era that he calls cosmetic psychopharmacology. Kramer is the author of the bestseller Listening to Prozac, his reflections on how Prozac and other new antidepressants are altering the personalities of patients and changing our notions of what makes people the way they are. Kramer is an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Brown University, and he has a private practice in Providence. Our interview was first broadcast in June. By popular request, we're featuring it today on our weekly archive edition of Fresh Air. Prozac went on the market in late 1987. Since that time, it's been portrayed as a breakthrough drug. But it's also been accused of causing suicidal feelings and violent behavior in some users. I asked Dr. Kramer what Prozac is typically prescribed for.
Prozac's usually prescribed for major depression, serious episodes of depression that don't seem to be ending spontaneously. It also can be prescribed for a number of other conditions, including obsessive-compulsive disorder. But in recent months, I think psychiatrists have more and more been prescribing Prozac for more minor forms of depression.
Now, I want you to give us an example of how you've seen a patient's personality change after taking Prozac. Maybe you can give us the story of the woman who you call Tess.
Yeah. Tess is a patient who was very important to me, I think, in part just because I admired her. This is someone, and do admire her. This is someone who came from a very rough background, a family of 10 raised by an alcoholic father and a mother who had great difficulty and ended up chronically depressed herself at a young age. And Tess took over, raised the family, made sure that all her siblings went through school, ended up herself with an excellent business career, but had very serious trouble in her private life, allowed herself to get into relationships with men where she was taken advantage of, strung along. And had privately markedly low self-esteem, although she did very well in public. And she came to me when she was becoming seriously depressed, and I and her psychologist slash psychotherapist were concerned that she might be entering the kind of chronic depression that her mother suffered at a similar age. And so I started her on a conventional antidepressant and happened to be imipramine, which is called a tricyclic antidepressant, the kind of treatment that was the mainstay of psychopharmacologic treatment for depression since the late 1950s until the late 80s. And she did well. She recovered from depression. She said she was all better. But I thought she was not perfectly well. And my marker for her not doing well was that when she mentioned her boyfriend, she was having an affair with a married man. When she mentioned this married man in the brief sessions we had to review medication, she would burst into tears. And I thought that that kind of vulnerability was not right for a woman of this extraordinary achievement. And when Prozac came on the market, for various reasons, in fact, in part because I thought this relationship to men had a compulsive quality, and because it, for various reasons, it seemed that Prozac might be good for compulsions, I asked her if she'd be willing to try a different medicine, and she was. She came in after a few weeks and said she was better than well, that she'd never been as well as she was then. And she showed what really for a psychiatrist is a remarkable change, for a psychiatrist to see is a remarkable change.
Tell us about some of the changes she went through.
Well, I think the most marked thing was that she was able to leave this boyfriend very easily, without falling apart, without any sense of regret. She had increased energy, she was more assertive at work, but she also seemed to have new social skills. She could spark in court, she could tease and flirt with men, she had confidence in her sexuality, she was able to judge what the right level of involvement with different men was. And I think as someone who's worked with people who get stuck in relationships, I find that those skills seem to take a long time to develop ordinarily, almost to need to be taught. And she just had those skills latently, and they emerged when the Prozac kicked in.
So she went through a very dramatic personality change. But didn't she at some point decide, or maybe you decided, to stop the Prozac?
Yes. You know, ordinarily, the rule used to be, at least, that if a person does very well, perfectly well, on an antidepressant for 5 or 6 months, you can stop without great fear of relapse. And we stopped the medicine, and in fact, she didn't relapse in the sense that she didn't have depression recur. But she came in again after a few months and said that she was not quite herself. I found that statement quite really remarkable. She was more the way she'd been for her whole life, and that now felt to her like not herself. The way she'd been on Prozac for 5 or 6 months now was what she felt was her true self. And the way she'd been for 35 years was not herself. And in particular, she was entering into new negotiations at work and felt that she'd been more confident on medication and asked me to restart the medication in order to increase her level of confidence.
And what was the dilemma for you about whether to start that or not?
Well, that really is not an indication for a psychotherapeutic medication, is it? I mean, that's not an illness. And I think I was able to kid myself and say, well, here's someone with chronic minor depression. Here's someone whose mother did very poorly once she started slipping. Maybe we ought to restart the medication. But I think if I'd been more honest with myself, I think I was really responding to her request, which was she wanted to be more confident and that more ebullient, buoyant, flexible personality. And she wasn't manic at all. She had no overshot, but that she just had a different kind of normal personality than the kind of normal personality she'd had before her depression. In any case, I think that I was really responding for her request to have a brighter personality. And I gave her the medication, and she had just the response she wanted.
Do you think you did the right thing, looking back?
I think I did the right thing. I think there's an interesting social question, which is, why is it that doctors have the right to prescribe or withhold medication? It's really on the basis of our expertise regarding health and illness. It's not because we have some proprietary hold over these drugs or that we have some moral reason to withhold them from people who wish them. But that is a very difficult question. I mean, really, I think it stresses the doctor's role to have the doctor in charge of a medication that perhaps can do more than alleviate illness.
Well, you've coined a new expression, cosmetic psychopharmacology. And in other words, prescribing pills to change somebody's personality as opposed to get them out of a life-threatening depression.
Well, I think Tess's case made me worry about this. You know, if you only go through life once, why not as a blonde? Well, why not as a peppy, energetic, socially proficient blonde? And I don't think that everybody would respond to this medication the way Tess did. In fact, some people don't respond to these medicines at all. But even if a substantial number of people with normal levels of mood respond to medication with this kind of socially desired change in personality, we have an interesting set of dilemmas on our hand.
Spell it out for us. What are the dilemmas?
Well, I think the dilemma is exactly the one you ask about, which is who has the right to decide whether a person ought to be on these medications? And in addition, I think there's another issue, which is are these medicines somehow analogous to steroids in sports? If some people go on these medications that are more confident, assertive, perhaps even quick-thinking at business than they were off them, does that put implicit coercive pressure on other people equally to take medication or some other way to achieve that level of assertiveness? In fact, the medication made me think about our society. I ask in the book why it is that medicines like Valium and Librium were so popular in the 60s and wonder whether they were related to our wish to have women stay in situations which perhaps should have made them anxious. but instead persevere. I think now we demand that women, and women are the people most often prescribed psychotherapeutic medication, that now we demand that women go out into the workplace and succeed, and by luck we have a medicine that may help them do that. So I think the medicine may be a boon, but it also implicitly may be socially coercive or induce a kind of conformity of temperament. I talk in the book about, as an example of this, about mourning, and I'm not the first person to write about this, but in rural Greece, there's a wonderful book that describes mourning rituals in rural Greece. And in rural Greece, women are expected and even required to mourn for predeceasing children or spouses for 5 years. And this is wonderful in terms of the amount of time it allows people for healing and growth, although it is stressful for some women who are so flexible that those 5 years are really burdensome. Well, our society doesn't allow people to mourn for 5 years. In fact, psychiatrists and internists will think about giving antidepressants after 6 months or a year if someone is really handicapped by grief. And by the way, most people are. Mourning, I think, naturally goes on for more than 6 months or a year. So we're a very different society, and I think the availability of this medication will highlight the extent to which we demand flexibility and resilience in people.
So you're cautioning us that there's a question now of whether we'll be altering personality to conform to the cultural norms of the day.
Yeah, I think there's a cultural norm for temperament. If we think about women again, the woman who is loyal, willing to stay at home, I'm not sure I'm going to get the list of characteristics I want, but who is sensitive, shy. You can look back to the Victorian literature and find these women as heroines of literature in the 19th century, although there's a tradition of the kind of spunky heroine as well that goes back to the 18th century, going right up to the present. We may not reward that temperament or personality today. I think today we may say to that woman, you're not going to do as well if you don't go out into the world and respond to changes in cognitive set very quickly, respond to changes and demands on you. In fact, there's an interesting study by a person who primarily studies monkeys, and he studied, instead of a colony of monkeys, a colony of mildly depressed women in California, had them come in for hundreds of hours of testing, and he came to believe in these women that their primary problem was not depression. Their primary problem was temperament. That is, that these women were not very outgoing. In fact, there was an interesting little sidelight to the study, which was that when the women went out for lunch, they wouldn't come back on time. So he sent his researchers out to follow the women and see what they did at lunch. What they would do if they came, let's say they had to go to the bank and the greengrocer and the butcher and the laundry. They'd come to the bank, there'd be a long line, and they would just stand on line instead of having the flexibility to move on to the next task and come back to the bank later. As a result, they wouldn't get their tasks done at lunch. And he hypothesized jokingly that the last two or three people on a long line will always be people with minor depression. Now, what he found was that these women had, if you look at this sort of an anthropologist, had less living space, fewer friends, less money. In fact, in general, fewer of the goods of life that lead us to be resilient and less depressed than women who weren't dysthymic. And his conclusion, which may or may not be right, but is very interesting, was that the primary problem in a number of mildly depressed women is that they have this more reserved, inhibited temperament, and that depression is secondary, that the depression is really on the basis of deprivation.
That's really interesting. Would this make the argument that it would be doing them a favor to treat them, that they'd get more of what they deserve in the world?
It certainly does them a favor in this society, I suppose, to treat them if you can make them less inhibited and more outgoing. On the other hand, I suppose we could say it enforces a level of social conformity. I think the doctor faced with the individual patient almost always has to give the drug because that patient needs to do better in the world here and now. But I think we could say as a society, are we doing the right thing if we don't create a place where people with that temperament, which is a normal temperament, which has persisted for generations and centuries, is able to succeed?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Kramer. He's a psychiatrist who teaches at Brown University and is the author of the new book, Listening to Prozac. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Peter Kramer is my guest, psychiatrist and author of the new book, Listening to Prozac. Has Prozac changed your sense of your job and your power? I mean, as you write in your book, you were used to doing a lot of talk therapy in addition to prescribing drugs, and you'd see personalities change very slowly over the course of long-term therapy. And now with some patients for whom you describe Prozac, you see remarkably quick personality changes. So what has this done to your sense of your job and your sense of when talk therapy is appropriate and when a drug is appropriate?
I think there's been a profound change within my sense of self. I think there's something humanly pleasing about the notion that the truth sets people free and that the truth, especially discovered in the course of an intimate relationship, is what is able to liberate people of the inhibiting parts of their personality, inhibiting or inhibited. And I think people who go into psychotherapy, especially psychiatrists who come to psychotherapy through medicine, that people who choose to center their careers around psychotherapy are not primarily technicians. They're people who are interested in empathy and intimate human relationships. And I think it is in some ways uncomfortable to discover the power of a technology. And Prozac has a particular feeling to me, not just Prozac, but these new, more potent and specific antidepressants. They're really high-tech design drugs. They come from a level of chemistry with which even most doctors are not familiar. So that here one is using an unknown, high-tech, highly developed substance, putting into someone's body in order to change something that heretofore you thought changed only through an intimate examination of the person's history. So I think there's something disturbing about that, although there's always something wonderful about being able to help. And I think these medicines can be immensely helpful.
You say patients have told you that they've learned a lot about themselves from taking Prozac.
Yeah, you know, I titled the book Listening to Prozac, and I think there's some things, there's a measure of irony embedded in the title. Of course, drugs don't talk to us. But I think patients often act as if the drug were talking. I start the book with a story of a man who was on Prozac ultimately for depression, but who prided himself before medication on his sexually liberated personality. He had fights with his wife because she wouldn't join him in his enjoyment of pornographic videos. And he took the Prozac for depression and also for a degree of compulsiveness. And when he was on the medication, he did very well. He was one of these people who was transformed, was quicker at work, was able to do his job better, felt better than well, like Tess. But in addition, he found he no longer enjoyed pornographic videos. And this was disturbing to him on the basis of thought. That is, he came in and he said, you know, that love of pornography really was a compulsion. It was biological happenstance. And I say in the book that the drug agreed with his wife when she was being critical. And so this was somewhat disconcerting or even humiliating for him.
Because he lost a part of himself that he defined himself by.
Yes. And now we don't have to agree with that. We could say, well, there's another reason why when he felt more secure, he didn't need to fall back on videos, because I think that these drugs give people, for those who respond to them, give them a sense of security and confidence. And one could say, well, when a person's secure, he doesn't need the sorts of responses to anxiety that he relied on before. But I think the patient experienced this with great immediacy. It felt to him as if a compulsion had been removed. He thought he learned something about himself, and that's part of what I mean by listening to Prozac, that he felt the drug had told him something about the deepest part of himself, about what was really self and what was just happenstance.
Do you think drugs like Prozac are raising new questions about what creates personality? For instance, some drugs have led to theories that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance that can be fixed with medication. Are there similar theories now arising about personality that it has a kind of chemical basis?
Yes, there are these theories go up and down. There's an interesting researcher at the University of Washington, St. Louis, named Bob Cloninger, who initially outlined a theory of personality based on the very same neurotransmitters that we think about in depression and in diseases like schizophrenia. so that he thought that these neurotransmitters, dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin, affected axes of personalities like harm avoidance or risk-taking, and that you could really describe a person in terms of his levels of these neurotransmitters. Now, I just was at the annual psychiatric meetings in May in San Francisco, and Dr. Cloninger had dropped parts of this theory and added other elements of personality. So I don't think we're at the stage where we can define personality biologically, thank goodness, I might add. But I think that more and more different parts of what we consider to be intimate to personality are considered to be biological. For instance, there's this whole body of research on social inhibition or inhibition to novelty in children, children who are afraid either socially or afraid of new situations. And there's some evidence, not very strong evidence, but stronger than evidence we've had in the past, that this trait is fairly constant throughout life. It's not very constant, but more constant than some other traits, and that it may relate to the state of the neurotransmitters. In fact, you can breed monkeys to be inhibited in this way, and you can treat the inhibition with medications very much like Prozac.
Say you've prescribed Prozac for a patient, and they've undergone what they and what you see as very positive personality changes. Mm-hmm. When they stop taking Prozac, do those changes stick, or do they revert back to who they were before? And if they revert back to who they were before, how do they feel about it?
Some people revert immediately. There's some people who suffer a relapse in depression or just a sense of being unassertive and unconfident as soon as they come off medication. The response seems to be on and off like a switch, and I think these people, that response is quite remarkable. Here are people whose personality seems entirely dependent on the state of whatever neurotransmitters these antidepressants affect. Other people do well for a while, but find themselves slowly slipping into a state similar to what they felt before the medication, what they experienced before the medication. Other people just go on and continue to do well. I happened to see Tess, the patient whose story we talked about earlier, just a couple of weeks ago. She's been off medication for many months, and she's doing fine. She says she occasionally feels more depressed than at other times. She goes up and down, and she said she thinks about going on medication now and then. It's as if she were living with a medication as part of her mental world, even though she's not on it. But she hasn't felt she's needed it. And when I saw her, I felt she was still buoyant, resilient, and flexible. I felt she was doing very well. And there are a number of explanations for that. It may be that these medications induce a change in the neurotransmitters or the receptors for neurotransmitters, which is stable. It may also be that just feeling secure for a while allows people to grow or to change their social circumstances in a way that results in what appears to be long-term personality change. So these medications may act an awful lot like depression. They may create a holding environment. They may give a person an experience of success. And people, you know, people are remarkable. They can give them a chance, and they can build on whatever you give them.
Dr. Peter Kramer is the author of the new book, Listening to Prozac. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Dr. Kramer will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm... From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. With new high-tech antidepressant drugs, Are we treating mental sickness or just medicating the human condition? Coming up, we continue our conversation with psychiatrist Peter Kramer. He wrote the bestseller Listening to Prozac after seeing how the antidepressant drug Prozac altered the personalities of some of his patients. For many, it had a positive effect, but its effectiveness has raised troubling ethical and social issues. Also, the Clampets have really hit the big time. The popular TV family from the 60s is in the movies now. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Beverly Hillbillies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Pentagon says that the U.S. Navy will help enforce U.N. sanctions against Haiti, set to go into effect Monday, if military leaders there do not take steps to move the nation toward democracy. President Clinton has also ordered some 600 U.S. Marines to be on standby at the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. These troops could be used to bring out American citizens that might be threatened or to protect U.S. property. And NPR's David Wellner reports from Port-au-Prince that U.N. personnel are being moved to a safer area.
The U.N. peace mission here, which is comprised of about 300 people, has been ordered to pull out of the country immediately. They are going to go to the neighboring Dominican Republic on the same island. And this was decided because of the security situation here. Dante Caputo, who's the head of the mission, says there are no guarantees for these people anymore. There have been numerous threats against members of the mission. It also appears that a contingent of 46 U.S. soldiers who've been here in Haiti since last week is preparing to pull out as well. This is also because of the fact that there are no guarantees here.
NPR's David Wellner reporting from Port-au-Prince. President Clinton has ordered half a dozen U.S. ships to enforce the U.N. embargo, and the U.S. has called on the U.N. to authorize the use of warships to search cargo ships near Haiti. Earlier this week, armed men prevented the landing of U.S. and Canadian support troops on Haiti, sent there as peacekeepers. On Capitol Hill, the House has overwhelmingly approved another extension of jobless benefits for people who have used up their regular benefits. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The vote was not close, 302 to 95 in favor of the 13-week extension. Most Democrats backed the added benefits, while Republicans were evenly split. Some said that with a national unemployment rate of 6.7%, a point lower than its recent peak, the added benefits were unnecessary. Another federal welfare program, said Republican Bill Archer of Texas. Democrats countered that the number of Americans who have been out of work for more than 6 months is unusually high, despite the improving economic picture. The most controversial part of the legislation, how to pay for the $1.1 billion extension. The House decided to make some immigrants wait 5 years instead of three before becoming eligible to collect welfare, a method blasted by Hispanic lawmakers. The measure now moves to the Senate. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
The government says that the nation's trade deficit dropped in August, moving down 6.8%. The country's trade deficit was aided by an increase in sales of U.S. airplanes and a drop in oil bought from other countries. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 8 points to close at 3,629.73 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The government says that people collecting Social Security will have a cost of living increase next year of 2.6%. It was the second smallest increase in nearly 20 years, indicating the nation's low inflation rate. Officials say the inflation increase will average $17 a month, and that means the typical monthly benefit will come to $674. The Space Shuttle Columbia has been grounded once again, this time because of a technical problem. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
One of the shuttle's two communications receivers went down. The S-band transponder, as it's known, allows the crew to communicate with Mission Control in Houston. Although one transponder is enough to complete the communications link, NASA's launch criteria require that both be operational prior to liftoff. The agency had considered waiving that rule and allowing the astronauts to repair the receiver while in orbit. They also considered sending technicians out to the launch pad to repair the hardware, but estimated that it could not be done before the end of the launch window. The unit will now be replaced over the weekend. Columbia's cargo of 48 rats will be removed also and replaced with another set in time for the shuttle's new launch date, now set for Monday morning at 10:53 Eastern Time. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
In Bosnia, UN officials say that they have been given new assurances by Serbian military leaders that UN aid convoys will be allowed to travel to northern Bosnia. However, local Serbian officials said that this cannot take place until sometime next week. A UN convoy has been blocked this week from getting to some 150,000 Muslims cut off by both Serbian and Croatian forces. Food and medicine has not reached them since early in June. Officials say the area is desperate for medical supplies as well as for food. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're continuing our interview with Dr. Peter Kramer, author of the bestseller Listening to Prozac. It's an exploration of antidepressant drugs and how they're being used to reshape personality. Our interview is recorded in June. We're featuring it as part of our weekly archive series. Dr. Kramer is an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Brown University, and he has a private practice in Providence. He wrote his book after watching the quick and dramatic personality changes some of his patients underwent while taking Prozac. His book raises many questions about the effect of mood-altering drugs on the modern sense of self. If we can remake personality to some extent through drugs,
yes,
that doctors prescribe, what's the difference between the drugs you would describe in the remaking of the self through, say, marijuana or LSD or cocaine or heroin? Now, granted that some of those drugs that I just mentioned are addicting and, have side effects, but who knows, I mean, what side effects we're going to find out about from Prozac.
Yeah.
Does that raise new questions about those other drugs?
Yes, I think that these new antidepressants are disturbing in just the way that you ask about. After all, a patient like Tess, who came from a very rough background, might under other circumstances be taking street drugs. And there is a theory of street drug taking, which has it, that people select drugs on the basis of their neurochemical needs. That is, really, people who are taking cocaine may be people who really would do well on antidepressants. People who are taking opium or heroin, maybe people who have a neurological problem with violence. I don't think anyone believes that's strictly true, but there's some sense that street drugs are really a form of self-medication, and maybe what's going on with prescribed drugs is something very similar in a controlled setting with fewer side effects and so on. I think that, it will be even more disturbing if we find a short and immediately acting medication that affects personality and doesn't have a lot of side effects. What if there were a form of amphetamine that didn't make people paranoid? You know, so that I think that once you start going down this road of thinking about potent, specific drugs without a lot of side effects that can affect aspects of personality, taking people from one normal state to another normal state, when you start thinking about that, you open a host of questions, and surely one of those questions is, what's the difference between drug taking on the basis of prescriptions and a relationship with a doctor and drug taking, on the basis of buying drugs on the street.
Mm-hmm. How much do we know now about the side effects of Prozac and other antidepressants?
Well, we know a fair amount about the early antidepressants. They were developed in the late 1950s, and people have been on them for a long time, even though they were initially only tested for short-term use. Certainly people have been on them for the long term, and this is very important because newer research seems to indicate that for certain patients it makes sense to keep them on antidepressants for a very long time. Obviously, we know less about the newer drugs. These drugs are tested in patients who are kept on them for a few months, and in reality, in clinical practice, people are sometimes kept on drugs like Prozac for years, and no one knows what that means. Also, no one knows what the downstream effects are. The drugs that are used to treat schizophrenia, the antipsychotics, turned out very early, it was realized, to have late-appearing, or what are called tardive effects. That is, someone would take the medication, might be off the medication for a number of years, and then might get a quite awful neurological syndrome on the basis of having taken the medicine. Of course, we don't know that about Prozac. We don't know someone who takes Prozac now is going to discover in 20 years. Let me say on the other side, though, that we don't fully know what the bad effects of depression are. It certainly doesn't seem good to be depressed. Depression seems to affect the immune system, but more particularly, being depressed seems to predispose people to further depression. The more frequently you're depressed, the more deeply you're depressed, the longer depression lasts, the greater your odds of being depressed in the future. So it's not just that the drugs have unknown side effects down the road. There's some risk in depression and probably even in minor depression.
How often do patients who take Prozac end up with worse depression or feeling even suicidal?
Nobody knows the answer to that. It's probably a small percentage of the time. All antidepressants seem occasionally to cause worsening of depression, and there's been a lot of publicity about Prozac and suicide or violence. On a theoretical basis, Prozac ought to decrease violence. If you give medicines like this to aggressive animals, you decrease their depression. In fact, there's a new word in psychopharmacology, serenic. Certain medications are said to be serenics because they seem to be able to treat impulsive aggressiveness. And these medicines like Prozac that raise serotonin transmission levels seem to be good at decreasing aggression. However, it may well be on the basis of side effects, and no one knows very well why this ought to be, that occasionally people become more depressed and even violent and suicidal on these medicines. It can't be a very frequent side effect, though. This is a drug that's been given to 4.5 million or more Americans, probably 8 million people or more worldwide. And it doesn't seem to be a side effect that occurs very often, if in fact it occurs at all.
Aren't there a lot of just really common, more minor side effects? Nausea, headaches?
Yes. Yes.
I just want to make it clear about these side effects because we're talking about all these like remarkable personality changes, and I don't want to mislead anybody that it's a, you know, a wonder drug without side effects.
I think that's a danger. This book has raised for me the question of what the writer's responsibility is. I think someone who reads the book will understand that this is not a drug without side effects. And the book, in fact, isn't a book that says Prozac is wonderful. It's a book that says Prozac is interesting.
Right.
It's remarkable. It's not a panacea. It's not harmless. But I think there's a question about whether I'm just responsible for what I say or whether writers are also responsible for how books are misinterpreted, hyped, and so on. And I really hope that the result of this book is to make people understand better or re-examine how it is they're put together, not to make them run out and take medication inappropriately.
My guest is psychiatrist Peter Kramer. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Dr. Peter Kramer. He's the author of the new book, Listening to Prozac, A Psychiatrist Explores Antidepressant Drugs and the Remaking of the Self. I'm wondering if you've ever tried Prozac, either for depression or just as an experiment to see what impact it would have on you since you're so interested in the meaning of Prozac now.
I haven't. You know, occasionally a group of friends will get together and say, let's all take this and write a book about it. I feel that I have some kinship to my, I feel I have great kinship to my patients, but in particular, you know, I think we all do have a sense of losing confidence, having our mood drift, thinking less well. I think those states of being a little less sharp are very common, and I suspect that I have a fair sense of what it's like to be up and down in the way my patients are, although maybe not in terms of going down, certainly not to the extent that certain of these patients have. In terms of their experiencing depression. But anyway, I haven't taken the medicine, and I write in the book about what I call psychopharmacological Calvinism, the sense that there's inevitably some bad payback for taking a medication. And perhaps I subscribe to some of that superstition myself.
Do you worry that at some point what we're doing is medicating the human condition, that a certain amount of depression is not only normal, but you'd be crazy if you didn't feel it considering the world we live in? And do you want to medicate that or not, you know?
Yeah, I think it's worse than that. I think we're not only medicating the human condition, we're redefining the human condition. When I say that in rural Greece, women are expected to mourn for 5 years, and here we're expected to mourn for 6 or 12 months. I think medications like these new antidepressants may underline the sense that mourning for more than 6 or 12 months is pathology. So that, I think it goes beyond medicating the human condition. We may redefine the human condition in a way that downplays the role of suffering or difficult emotion. I was on the radio once before. It was on KPFA Pacifica in Berkeley, which is a taken a somewhat left-wing liberal anyway news station. And on the wall outside was a painting which talked about someone feeling pain, going down into the pain, and going down into El Salvador. There was a sense that somebody had transformed her pain into political action. Well, I think that these new antidepressants aren't about transforming your pain into political action. They're about removing pain. However, that being said, I think that people who are marginalized because they're unable to act politically, in fact, unable to act at all socially, are given power by these new antidepressants. So that I think there's something to be said for them on that score, that there, it really is different to take a medication and have it make you passive and medicated, quotes around medicated, and taking a medication and having it make you active and assertive.
Well, I think it's fair to say you're raising a lot of interesting questions, but you don't want to give us any simple answers for them.
Thank you. I hope that's right.
How much does Prozac cost, and how much do you think that the cost of the psychiatrist and the cost of the drug will determine who gets to have the kind of personality changes that will help them and who doesn't?
Right. Well, you know, this is an old question with psychotherapy. Is psychotherapy or psychoanalysis just for the rich? And I think under any health insurance scheme, medication is going to be less expensive than psychotherapy. So Prozac costs about $2 a pill, but that is still less expensive than good psychotherapy by a well-trained therapist. And I think there's the danger under managed care or managed competition that organizations will offer medication and very little psychotherapy by very poorly trained therapists, and that will not serve people well. I do want to say that not everyone responds to the drugs in the way these very good responders do. Some people respond well, some people have an intermediate response, some don't respond at all, and some just experience side effects without any main effect.
Do you feel that other doctors in your field are dealing with the ethical questions that you're raising about when it's appropriate or inappropriate to prescribe antidepressants?
You know, I think that there are doctors who would deny what I'm saying and say that medications only treat illness and that if it responds to medication, it was an illness. I would say that that mischaracterizes most drugs, that most of the drugs we use can affect healthy people as well as ill people, and also that it will serve to expand the definition of illness to a degree that is in itself a form of social change. There's a group of young doctors I mentioned in the book, Bob Aronow and Richard Schwartz at Harvard, Mark Sullivan at University of Washington, Seattle, and Ron Winchell at Columbia, who are very involved in writing and thinking about ethical dilemmas related to these medications. I think it's the younger doctors who just assume that the role of the psychiatrist is going to be to combine psychotherapy and pharmacotherapy, and that this really is the cutting edge. This is the goal of psychiatry in the 1990s and on into the next century, is precisely to wrestle with the practical and the ethical questions involved in using these two very powerful and wonderful tools.
Do you find that you're relying less on talk therapy than you used to?
You know, I tend to use talk therapy with patients as my primary means of treatment and only to give medication secondarily. And there may be good reason for that. The patients I write about in this book very largely have been in psychotherapy either with me or somebody else. And perhaps they just need some small extra thing in order to change. And what appears to be rapid transformation may be rapid transformation after 2 years of psychotherapy. You know, it may be some kind of releasing of a person into some other state for which he or she had the latent potential. However, I think there are people who just do well on these medications without talk, and I think all psychiatrists' sense of what to do first may be changing. I don't think we will ever not need psychotherapy. I really think that there is nothing like self-understanding, experiencing a constant relationship with someone who tolerates and appreciates the other. It would be very disturbing to me if we found medications that could entirely replace psychotherapy.
Dr. Peter Kramer is the author of the bestseller Listening to Prozac. That's Kenny Barron at the piano, and this is Fresh Air. The U.S. is stepping up pressure on Haiti. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what will you have from Haiti on All Things Considered?
We're covering President Clinton's decision, Terry, to send U.S. ships to patrol off Haiti, adding a naval blockade element to the sanctions. We'll have a report from here, one from Port-au-Prince, and then we will review the history and policy of U.S. relations with Haiti. We'll also have a report on gays in the military. We'll visit Hershey, Pennsylvania, to see how the candy company has mated hugs with kisses. We'll look at the GATT negotiations and the movie element of the GATT treaty, and we'll have a review of The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Penelope Spheeris used to make dark, punky, low-budget films about violent youth, and her claims to fame during the 80s were her intentionally shocking rock documentaries, The Decline of Western Civilization, Parts 1 and 2. But in 1992, she made a smash hit called Wayne's World and left the underground behind. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see her new movie, The Beverly Hillbillies.
I suppose turning old TV shows into films makes life a lot easier in Hollywood. Instead of sitting across from a daunting production boss and saying, okay, what I've got is kind of a cross between Dances with Wolves and Indecent Proposal, only on skis. Now all you have to do is swagger in, sit down, and utter the words, my favorite Martian, and it's a done deal. So far there's been the Addams Family, Wayne's World, the Coneheads, the Fugitive, and there's no mystery about why Hollywood is turning old TV shows into movies. It's cheap, for one thing. And better still, you don't have to teach your potential audience what the Addams Family is about, so half your marketing is already done for you. There's just one catch. Why would anyone in his right mind want to see a movie of, say, The Beverly Hillbillies? If you're old enough to remember it from the early 60s when it was a hit sitcom, then you're too old to enjoy any of the film's jokes about belching, nose-picking, and a family that's so yokelish that it thinks Californians giving them the finger are just kind of saying howdy. You remember the premise, right? Hillbilly Jed Clampett, played here by Jim Varney, is out shooting for food when up from the ground comes bubbling crude. Oil, that is. Black gold. Texas tea. Stop me, please. Anyway, Jed is now a billionaire. He moves his family to a Beverly Hills mansion where he starts immediately looking for a wife. The search is taken up by Jed's new banker, Miss Hathaway, whom Lily Tomlin plays in a manic all-out homage to the role's originator, the late Nancy Culp. Here she is programming the bank's computer while Jed's heroically stupid nephew, Jethro, looks on.
So, Jethro, building on your visionary plan for finding your uncle's wife, I've created this rather modest database program. I've cross-referenced the applicants against the parameters you indicated he desired. By specifying the search criteria into functional groupings and selecting the field values through the use of embedded commands and, of course, basic Boolean algebra.
Miss Jane, I have no idea what you just said.
Oh, Jethro, you are so delightfully primitive.
What pleasure there is in this movie comes from skillful impersonation. Cloris Leachman is amazingly apt as Granny, although she hardly has anything to do. And Diedrich Bader, who plays Jed, is insufferable at first and then sort of charming, which is as it should be. Leah Thompson is proficient as an evil seductress who wants to marry Jed and then abscond with his zillions. Her plan provides the movie with about as much plot as it can handle. Penelope Spheris's direction, meanwhile, has all the deftness and subtlety of a Saturday morning cartoon show and seems aimed at the same audience. I'd say we should boycott pictures like this, but it won't do any good. Adam's Family Values and Wayne's World 2 are already on the way, and so is the Flintstones movie. And worst of all, The Beverly Hillbillies ends with the words, "Y'all come back now, you hear?"
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Devin Reeve is our intern. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a poet's memoir of youth. In 1950, James Merrill wanted to put an ocean between him and the life he'd known, so he set sail for Europe. His memoir is also about being born into wealth. His father co-founded Merrill Lynch. And about being gay before the gay rights movement. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.